It's 9:13, and good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Sundance Reel, along with my co-host, Katie Eldridge. Well, it's one of those you-have-to-see-to-know-it kind of experiences, but I'll do my best with this one. Confronting the way we understand and talk about race in America, director Roger Ross Williams uses virtual reality documentary to immerse the viewer in the long history of restriction of movement for Black Americans and the creation of safe spaces in our communities. It puts you smack dab in the middle of a 3D, 360-degree setting of Ben's Chili Bowl Cafe in Washington, D.C. The director, Roger, welcome to Sundance Reel.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So tell us how this piece came to be. I mean, did you have the idea and then decide to do VR, or it was a VR project to begin with?
Yeah, no, it started 8 years ago. Bonnie Nelson Schwartz, my executive producer, produced a play in D.C. with about Victor Green. He's the guy who wrote The Green Book, starring the late Julian Bond. And she had an idea to do a documentary, and I said, let's not do a documentary. Let's do, at the time, it was 8 years ago, I said, let's do something called transmedia, which is what it was called then. And it was a sort of a multimedia project. And Shari Freelo from Sundance said, you know, you should really look at VR. A couple years ago, she told me that. And that sort of started me on this VR journey because I'm a traditional doc filmmaker.
Yeah. So how do you think VR changes the experience of seeing this film then?
Yeah. Well, what's amazing to me is that with a VR experience like this, you can't turn away. You can't, you know, get up and go to the bathroom. You can't eat popcorn. You're fully immersed, and you're really trapped in the experience, which is great. So you're very, very, very focused. And I think that what's amazing is that, especially with this piece, is that you are so immersed in the conversation and in that world that you're able to sort of, as a white person, you're able to come out of your skin and be in a Black environment.
Yeah. Well, I'm smart, but I'm ignorant. I will admit that. And I had no idea what these green books were. You mentioned Victor Green. Tell us about that, because I didn't know about it until Saturday.
Yeah, the Green Book is a sort of a, you know, forgotten part of history. It was a guidebook that was used in the 30s and 40s and 50s for African Americans to travel around the country because you couldn't eat in restaurants or stay in hotels. You couldn't get gas at gas stations. There were sundown towns north and south. I think the first sundown towns were in the north. And so you had to figure out how to travel. You had to pack your food. So Victor Green, a postal worker in Harlem, created the Green Book, which was a book of homes where people would open up their homes and make meals for travelers if you're African American. And he crowdsourced it at the time across the country with other Black postal workers. So he created a guidebook.
It's kind of the AAA for African Americans, huh?
It's the AAA, yeah. It was very dangerous for Black people to travel back then.
How has the experience been watching people come to your exhibition, if we can call it that, at the Ray?
Yeah, it's been really powerful because people have been moved to tears and just crying hysterically. So you're dealing with a lot of tears because I think that if you're Black or if you're white, or whatever color, but if you're Black, it brings up a certain amount of sort of pain that you sort of carry, because as African Americans, when we travel through America, you could always be pulled. You've seen enough viral videos of people being pulled over by the cops and shot, and so that fear is always there, and sort of brings it to the surface. And if you're not African American, you're watching it, you get this sort of empathy. You understand what it's like. You sort of listen to these conversations, and at the end of the piece, it becomes, you kind of have an experience with Tamir Rice's mom, who, you know, losing a child to police who were oath bound to protect that child, the pain of losing a child, and many people can obviously connect with that. Is almost unbearable.
Yeah, and let's just talk a little bit more about that, because with the VR, the Oculus headset that you have on, you feel like you're sitting in the booth with Mrs. Rice.
Yeah,
as she's telling her story to an interviewer who I didn't recognize, who is like right to your left shoulder here. I mean, you feel like you're in this conversation, and at the same time, you can look at all of the other people sitting along the bar stools listening in on the conversation too. It's just the most different experience.
You know, Ben's Chili Bowl has been a refuge and a safe space for African American travelers for many years. It's the first started out as a silent movie theater, black silent movie theater, the Mini Haha, then was a pool hall, and for the last 66 years has been Ben's Chili Bowl, where the community comes together, and even once a week they have a historian come in and they have a storytelling. It's just a real community space. So when you're experiencing the piece and you're sitting in the booth and you're sort of part of a conversation with different people, when at the end, when Samira Rice tells her story of the death of her son, everyone stops and listens. It almost embraces her, and so that she feel you're sort of, you know, you feel that sort of warm embrace. The community comes around to sort of really listen to her and feel empathy with her.
Oh yeah, you want to just reach across the table and hold her hand, but, yeah. But it's like there's nothing there.
There's nothing there. There's nothing. And we rebuilt Penn's Chili Bowl at the Ray, so you really are in the space and you really get to feel what it's like in the space. And I find that after people watch it, you know, we have a counter, so you could go and sit at the counter and talk to other people who've had the experience and sort of, you know, decompress a little bit, because I think that's important, that you just don't walk away, that you can
actually have the conversation.
You can talk about it, yeah.
Yeah. So when you filmed it, I mean, was it just spontaneous, or was it?
It was very. It was a 4-day shoot, round the clock. Was very extensive shoot. You know, VR cameras is a big camera, and you know, because we recreate a time period, another time period, we take you to the early 60s, Ben's Chili Bowl. We had to art direct the entire restaurant. We had to bring in some actors, but mostly the community and wardrobe, and they had to dress in the 60s. So you can, there's a mirror you can along the wall, and you, when you look in the mirror, that's the interactive element. You can see Ben's back in the 60s. You can be on the bus with Cortland Cox, one of the civil rights workers who's telling his story in the booth, who, you know, had this harrowing experience on the bus traveling in the South. So you can sort of interact and with different sort of, you know, go into the story in another way, approach the story another way from looking in the mirror in that booth. So that was sort of doing all that, setting all that up was a lot of, it was pretty extensive.
Yeah, so you had some archival film then to work with as well?
Yeah, so it was, you start out in the theater, in the Mini Haha, and you're looking at a screen. It's funny because you're in a VR piece, but you're sitting in a theater, a traditional theater, looking at a screen.
Oh, okay, I didn't realize that was the same place.
Yeah. So you're looking at archival footage of African Americans traveling in the 50s and the 60s. And then that sort of transitions to the space.
I'm curious. So this was your first VR production?
Yes, it was.
And does it make you want to do more, or do you feel like I've been there, I've done that, we're good?
Well, I really enjoyed it. And, you know, what's amazing about VR for documentary, you know, I had experimented with lots of different types of VR, animation and CGI, and I just wasn't feeling the true power. As a documentarian, there's nothing like real people and connecting with real people and real stories, and I wanted it to feel real. And so I love VR because it's a form where the viewer is totally immersed. You are in the story and you have no choice but to experience it. You can't look away. You can't turn away. You know, there's no distractions. You're sort of trapped there.
And so what happens to it now if people don't get to experience this at Sundance? What's its future?
So you can experience it in 360 video on the New York Times app, which is a New York Times, I think it's / TWB. And you can experience on Oculus Rift, which you can download on the Oculus Rift headset. And then we are setting up traveling exhibits throughout the country. So we'll be going to museums and civil rights museums and working with the Museum of African American History and Culture, the Smithsonian. And we'll also be taking it, which I think is really important, to community centers and communities. So people in communities and also into schools. So there's a big, so we can break down this set and the set will travel around the country.
So this is just the beginning for
that. This is just the beginning, the big launch, but it's been amazing.
And for those people who are here, where, so it's at the Ray.
It's at the Ray, yes, yes. It's at New Frontier at the Ray. You can see it. It'll be on all week. Sign up. You got to get a ticket. People don't understand for New Frontier, you also have to get a ticket and sign up. But they can go see it anytime.
And they can do that through the app, I'm sure.
Yes, you can do it through the app.
Okay, awesome.
Well, I hope it makes it back to Utah so we can see more of it.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Director Roger Ross Williams with his Traveling While Black VR exhibit. You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
This is Dr. Juliana Miller with Miller Orthodontics, a supporter of KPCW and the Park City Education Foundation, which supports the Park City School District, putting every dollar raised back into our Park City children and teachers alike. More information about Miller Orthodontics at m2ortho.com.
Hi, this is Bill Rock. The Vail Epic Promise Foundation, a nonprofit organization, is a proud supporter of KPCW. The foundation provides Park City Mountain employees with grants in emergencies and for educational purposes. Information is available to Park City Mountain employees at epicpromise.com.
It's 9:24, and you're listening to the Sundance Reel. I'm here with my guest host, Katie Eldridge. Well, director Gurinder Chadha's new film, Blinded by the Light, is based on the memoir Greetings from Brewery Park, which chronicles the author's experiences as a British Muslim boy growing up in the 1980s and the impact that Bruce Springsteen's lyrics had upon him. Gurinder, welcome to the Sundance Reel.
Good morning.
So with the help of this author, Sarfraz Manzoor?
Yeah, Sarfraz Manzoor.
Okay. You developed the film out of your shared passion for Bruce Springsteen. You both met him at the London premiere of the Springsteen doc, The Promise, in 2010, and discovered that he had not only read but admired the book. So is that where you pitched the film to him?
Absolutely. Boy, did we pitch. Yes, we used that as our moment because once I read Sarfraz's book, I knew that the only way we were ever going to turn this into a film was to have Bruce's blessings. So we chose that moment, and on the red carpet, we were all ready to accost him. But what was wonderful was that he actually had read the book, and he came over and told Sarfraz what a beautiful book it was. So we chose that moment, jumped in and said, we want to turn it into film. Please support us. And he said, sounds good. Talk to John. And he pointed to John Landau and Barbara Carr and Tracy Nurse, his colleagues. And we made contact with them. And from there on started doing what was almost a Herculean task, which was to write a screenplay that we knew Bruce would like, because that was the only way this film was going to get made was if Bruce liked the screenplay.
And so, when was that initial red carpet event?
It was 2010.
Okay.
Yeah.
So did Bruce, has he seen the finished product, and what was his reaction?
So we obviously he liked the script, so we made the movie, and last year, 2017, I took what was almost my sort of final cut to New York to show it to him in a little room with some of his managers. And it was incredibly nerve-wracking, as you can imagine, because as we were sitting there waiting for Bruce to come in, John Landau said, what are you going to do if Bruce doesn't like it? You know, and it was the first time I kind of thought, oh my God, what am I going
You're like,
to do?
Thanks a lot.
You know, all these like 7 years of blood, sweat and tears. But I had made every decision in the film. Every decision I made was to honor his words and honor Sarfraz's words equally. So it was to bring both those, what seemed like two very different entities and their words together. And that's all I could do, was honor them. And so Bruce came in, said, hello, let's watch the movie. Like, no chit-chat. You know, you don't get chit-chat with Bruce. and we watched it, and I sat behind him, and I was able to watch his crow's feet, you know, as the reactions. and he laughed, and he was very taken. And at the end, once I turned the lights on, he walked over, and he gave me a big hug and a kiss and said, thank you for looking after me so beautifully.
So millions would agree that Springsteen's music is transformative. I mean, why do you think it's such a good match for today's current times?
Well, Springsteen's music is not romanticized. It is lyrical, it is beautiful, it is powerful. And what he sings about really is reality. Life is tough. He says life is tough. And you've just got to find beauty in the little things around you that give you hope and give you pleasure. So girls, you know, that, as we say in the film, those are his salvation. He's got a lot of songs about girls. You know, he has a lot of songs about, you know, working hard and the ordinary working man, you know, trying to make it. And these are those times, you know, where ordinary people, I think, do feel alienated. I think we have political leaders all over the world, you know, who are sometimes, you know, riding roughshod over the kind of society that we might want to see, you know, and want our children to be part of. And instead you have agendas of division, dissension, and really this film is showing the power of how universal we are and how we kind of all laugh and cry at the same things and kind of want the same things out of society and out of our neighbors.
Yeah. Every Bruce fan has a favorite song. What's yours, and is it in the film?
So if you ask any Bruce fan that, they'll tell you that that's an impossible question.
You know the right answer.
Exactly. Impossible.
Okay, so but saying that, what is it?
No. Yeah. There are different songs for different times.
Right.
I have to say, obviously, there are all the classics. If you ask me what I replay over and over, like I've heard it once and I've got to put it on again, I would say Thunder Road. I would say Jungle Land. These are two songs to me that are so powerful and are little movies in themselves. They tell stories which are very filmic. So I love those. One of my go-to albums always is Ghost of Tom Joad because of it is the essence of Bruce. I said very publicly at the time, post 9/11, that I thought The Rising was one of the most eloquent responses to 9/11 by an American ever. And I still stand by that. So, yeah, you want me to go on? Should we just show
no,
that,
I'm
Bruce?
Just. I know. I'm just having flashbacks. Oh.
So, do you use the soundtracks? I mean, is it his music or is it? Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen it. I'm sorry, but
yeah, it's we honor the words of Springsteen, you know, and the philosophy of the man, and his guidance on how to get through tough times, if you like. And so it's not really a musical as such, but we do use his music extensively to help guide our character, you know, on his journey. And the strength for me was to make his words fit our narrative. So I had to believe that the songs that I've used of Bruce's are 17 songs, but there are also other songs from the 80s, you know, Pet Shop Boys, and, you know, we even have Tiffany in there. And and Bruce loved that we had all these other 80s songs, not just his, because it gave you a full context of the world that he was writing in, you know, up to 1987. The power of his words was really in the screenplay was I had to get to a point where I felt that he had written these songs just for me and my movie, you know, although they exist separately for him and millions of Bruce fans around the world. We took his songs and made them feel like they were part of our narrative and they belong to our film.
And what kind of reaction? Tell us about your premiere.
Wow, that was amazing, because from day one I had always wanted the first audience screening of the film to be here at Sundance, which I believe is the premier festival for independent movies. And I wanted, so no one, literally no one had seen the film, and I hadn't seen the film with an audience at all until the other night for the premiere. So I wasn't quite sure how it was going to go down, obviously. I mean, I knew obviously there were Springsteen fans in the audience. And when I introduced the film, I couldn't help burst into a verse of Hungry Heart with the audience. And everyone was singing along just to get in the mood. But what was wonderful was to see people clap during the movie. You know, there were moments. It's not a spoiler, but there is a moment where Javed and his friend come to Newark Airport And the passport guy stops them and says, what is the purpose of your visit? And he's quite stern. And because of memories of the Muslim ban and all this, you're sort of sitting there going, oh, boy, they're not going to let him in. What's going to happen? And you can see the crowd sort of tenses up. And he, passport official, says, hey, you know, to his friend, these guys are here, you know, purpose of their visit is to visit New Jersey, you know, to see Bruce Springsteen's hometown, you know. And the boys look at each other like, oh, my God. And then the passport official goes, I can't think of a better reason to visit the United States of America, and punches his passport. And the whole crowd erupted in applause because everyone was like, yeah, that's the America we want to be part of.
Right,
you know?
Like that's the way it should be.
That's the way it should be. And I think that, like, I mean, I've got chills thinking about it now. And in the second screening I was in, the same thing happened. So there is something about the film that calls on the kind of America that Javed looks up to and Javed wants to be part of, because it's Bruce's America. So I guess that was one thing I couldn't tell before. But now at Sundance and seeing it with a largely American audience, it's somehow capturing that sentiment that, you know, Bruce's America is certainly the one that the audience sort of wants to be part of.
You mentioned this is the first time you've had that experience at Sundance, but you're really so entrenched with this festival. How many times have you been here?
Oh, I've been here many times. I came here as a struggling filmmaker myself, and I was part of the Writers' Lab. And I developed a script there called What's Cooking, which then opened Sundance a few years later as the opening night film. And it's my Thanksgiving movie, which is on every year on TV, but no one knows that I made it, I think, because it's so American. But it's four families in LA who celebrate Thanksgiving, and it's that weekend. And there's an African-American family with Alfre Woodard and Dennis Haysbert, Latin American family, Mercedes Rule, Jewish American family with Kira Sedgwick and Juliana Margulies and Maury Chaykin, and a Vietnamese American family headed with Joan Chen. And these women and these parents, they're all trying to hold their families together, you know. And then, of course, on the Thanksgiving table, things kind of explode. And then you realize, even though they're from such diverse backgrounds, that all families deal with the same stuff, you know. So, yeah, that opened Sundance in the year 2000. And then I've been back. I came back with Bend It Like Beckham. I've been back with other movies. I came as a director to the lab.
Why do you keep? I mean, it sounds to me like you'll always come back. And I mean, you're open to the possibility of what's going to be different this year. I don't know. And to hear you speak at the Women in Sundance event was awesome.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I had my radical female hat on for that event.
Which was the proper attire.
Oh, thank you. I feel that we are all storytellers. Sundance, you know, is about storytelling, and people who are on the margins, you know, tell their stories and they get a platform here. People whose stories might not necessarily ever be seen are here. You know, people who are given a voice through the Sundance Institute, through, you know, as new writers, directors, actors, people at the festival, filmmakers. It's just a fantastic philosophy on filmmaking this place exudes. And I feel that, you know, I really wish we had something like this in Britain, you know. It's not commercial, although people have tried to make it commercial, you know. It still has its own identity. You still turn up at a red carpet in big snow boots and puffer jackets. Like, you know, for my premiere, I had a nice suit on, I had some jewelry, and everyone went, nah, take that off. I was like, okay, you know.
It's like, I forgot where I was.
Well, I was trying to make an effort.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on finally getting that big premiere, that, you know, big wow for yourself too, to get to experience the audience like that. What other screenings are coming up do we have?
We have Friday the 1st at 9:30, and I think that's the only local one, so you may have one more.
We have an extra one, actually, today, because of the demand. So this afternoon, there is an extra screening for people, and Actually, today to tomorrow. I'm sorry. I'm lost with what day.
It's okay. We didn't know what day it was either.
It's Tuesday,
you're
right?
You're with us.
It's Tuesday.
It's Wednesday. Wednesday afternoon. But we're very, very lucky. We had a lot of interest from a lot of great companies, distribution companies. So I do believe the film will be seen quite extensively across the U.S., you know, once it's released.
Okay. Well, again, thanks so much for your time. Again, we've been speaking with Gurinder Chadha, the director of Blinded by the Light. You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Claudia McMullen, founder of Hugo Coffee Roasters. At Hugo Coffee, we love two things, coffee and dogs, and not necessarily in that order. Part of Hugo Coffee's mission is to save rescue animals in our community. That is why we love sponsoring the KPCW Nuzzles & Co. Adoptable Moment during the KPCW Classified Show. Hugo Coffee, saving dogs, one cup at a time.
If you have a family history of diabetes, macular degeneration, glaucoma, or developing cataracts, having an annual eye exam is critical. This is Dr. Colleen Chuback with the Moran Eye Center at University of Utah Health. Early diagnosis and treatment can greatly reduce or prevent harm to your vision before damage occurs. Schedule your eye exam at the Redstone Health Center at 658-9200. University of Utah Health is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
It's 9:39. You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW. Well, director Allison Clayman is here today with The Brink. This is a documentary about former Trump strategist Steve Bannon. Welcome, Allison. Thanks for being with us.
So excited to be here. Thank you.
So why your decision to make a film about Steve Bannon?
Well, it was all about the opportunity that came to get access to him in a verite capacity. To me, this film was make or break. It was worth doing a movie if I could get real insight on him. And to me, the way to do that was not through interviews, a setting that he's really comfortable with, that combative style, changing the subject. I don't think he's really there to give a good faith answer, but to watch what someone who, you know, was instrumental in Trump becoming the president of the United States, vocal about the connection between Brexit and Trump's win, and wondering, you know, what he's going to do next. And in fact, this year, he's been kind of going around the world, articulating a vision of a united new far right, if you will. And to me, that's something that's really important to pay attention to. But, you know, without elevating him in any particular way, just really wanting to observe and see what it is. And the assumption was that he would reveal himself and sort of expose the limitations of what he's doing by just watching him. And I think that that's what happened.
So how did you get that access, or how did that opportunity happen?
So a producer that I know, Marie-Thérèse Girgis, approached me. This was summer of 2017, so Steve Bannon was still in the White House. And she knew him from the early 2000s when he and some investors had taken over an art house distribution company called Wellspring Media. And so he was her boss before the Tea Party and, you know, all those things that they shared nothing about their politics, but she knew him from that time, and she had an inkling that a movie like this would be valuable and that she might be able to convince him to do it. And I guess she asked me because, you know, well, she never asked anyone else, and I immediately said yes, pending meeting him, because I really didn't know what he would be like. But on that first meeting, I thought, you know, documentary, it's like casting in a way, and he was charismatic and had a lot to say, and I just was like, I think we're going to get the goods. You know?
So yeah, were there certain parameters that you said, yes, we're interested in doing this if X, Y, and Z, just so you're not wasting your time and getting those types of answers that you're talking about that he's so good at giving?
I mean, yeah, he had to understand that what I wanted was, you know, full access. Full access for any verite documentary doesn't mean you're, like, you know, in the shower with someone or that you get access to every private moment. But the idea being, like, I wanted to be in the room for meetings, you know. I wasn't interested in doing sit-down interviews. And in fact, the film has no talking heads. It's entirely like a direct cinema experience. Of course, there is interaction between us, but for me, you know, it's not so much my travels with Steve Bannon. However, I think the film, while it is, you know, a fly on the wall document, it's very much a distillation of my experience of Steve Bannon in the last year.
Has he seen it?
he has, you know, and he has no say in it. So I didn't show it to him, so I wasn't there.
Oh, so what was his reaction, though? Was he unhappy with it, or?
I think that what I heard, because I wasn't there, my producer showed it to him, was, you know, it was a lot to process. He's only seen it once in an almost finished form. So I think he's looking out for what's being written about it, I think, this week, as more people are seeing it. It premieres on Wednesday, so really it's still before the world is, you know, starting to write about it. And it's going to open in theaters March 29th. Magnolia Pictures it was an incredible partner and supporter and understood this project from the beginning, and they are releasing it in the U.S.
And the time sensitivity.
Yeah. And for us, it's also really important. We hope that we'll find partners to release it internationally, especially in Europe. One of the key things in the film is, you know, Bannon uniting far-right leaders in discussions about essentially taking down the EU, saying that if they can get a ruling minority of a third of the, I guess, the European Parliament delegates in the May 2019 election, so they're coming up, they feel like they can act as a bloc and start to accomplish some of the things they want to accomplish. So for us, there's an urgency as well for it to be seen internationally.
What were some of the surprises that came up for you getting to know this man, as you do when you're following someone around that much?
I mean, in some ways, everything was a surprise in the interpersonal, because I had no expectations. And I guess he has a charisma of his own, and he has a good, a self-deprecating sense of humor while also having, a healthy ego at the same time. So I found when I first met him, the thing that excited me was I thought there was going to be opportunity for humor, which to me is a sign that something is a real story, because I think even in the, you know, I've never made a movie about someone that I disagree with so strongly and who I think is such a threat and a danger. But I know that in, you know, times of trouble, and just being human is also to, you know, to have levity as well as serious moments. And so I was looking for that in this movie. And I feel like it has its own Veep moments, I'd say, as well.
Yeah. So the film, as you mentioned, started after his term at the White House.
Yes.
Stint at the White House. I didn't want a term. What did he have to say about that experience? I mean, or did you not even discuss it?
Well, there's a great line early in the film where he talks about how the White House, it has a bad karma. He didn't like it, and it's a bad karma. He is always spinning things, right? So I don't know what he really thought. I think that he tried to play it off like I was always going to leave the White House. And I didn't know him at that time in August when, days after Charlottesville, the Unite the Right rally calls for him to leave started growing, and then he left. He insists, you know, it was on his terms, and he feels he can be more potent outside of the, you know, formal restrictions of a position as a strategist in the White House. And again, that's part of why this movie, again, why I started it, was the feeling that that's probably true, you know? I mean, he is returning to running Breitbart News. And now he's seen as a, you know, kingmaker who has many people, you know, imagined a direct line to the White House. What is this guy going to go out and do? And I really did find that world leaders believe that. And I don't know. I always wondered if part of it was because all the staffing of the Foreign Service and, all the positions that haven't been filled by Trump. Right. It's probably the weirdest president, you know, to try to formally access. And so if you have this guy who's kind of going around and seen as really, he is famous. He is his own brand in a way. And I think a lot of people were taking meetings with him, not necessarily because he was promising them something that I don't know that, but they feel like this is the next best thing to Trump. So for the year, he was certainly always staying on message, supportive of Trump. But we'll see what happens as the next year comes.
I'm curious, as a filmmaker, how you go into this to tell this story when you have your own opinions, or you might feel a certain way about the subject of your documentary and how you do you need to compartmentalize that and go into it?
That's a nice word for it. Yeah. I mean,
well,
yeah.
You know.
No, I mean, I think so. That's a great word for it. I mean, it was really emotionally draining, I thought. And not because the people I was working with were mean to me or like, you know, intimidating me per se, but it was just I fundamentally disagree with everything that they think is the right way forward.
And you're hearing it all day, every day.
All day, right in my earbuds, you know. In an ideal world, he's wearing the microphone, you know, and keeping his face in focus. And he knew I was not there undercover, you know.
Yeah,
he
to
was
be like a cheerleader.
No,
or,
I mean, he was like our, you know, my Brown University commie lefty filmmaker over here. But the main terms was that I was gonna be it was gonna be fair, you know, and I do think it's fair. And I think that he thinks it's fair. I think it's probably not what he thought it would be. But you know. It was really, that part was really challenging, and how to have a professional relationship also with him and his whole team. And just, it was a big exercise in finding other things to talk about.
Right. The weather.
Basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Your premiere is tomorrow?
Yeah, tomorrow at 3 p.m. at the library.
Library. And then it'll screen again 8:30 a.m. on Thursday the 31st at the Egyptian. It'll also play in Salt Lake City
on
Saturday.
Yeah, I'll be there for all three.
Okay. The Brink, a documentary about former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon by Allison Clayman. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to the local Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
Support for KPCW comes from Squatters Roadhouse Grill and Pub, offering weekend brunch with traditional menu items such as Eggs Benedict and French toast, as well as Midday Marys and mimosas. On-site parking available. Squatters, good for what ails you. Squatters.com.
Support for KPCW is provided by Sundance Institute, a nonprofit organization. Tickets are on sale now for the Sundance Film Festival, running through February 3rd in Park City, Salt Lake City, and Sundance Resort. For more information and to purchase your tickets, visit sundance.org/tickets.
It's 9:50. Good morning. Well, although dead now for two decades, Ted Bundy is a name that can still call up fear. This charming, handsome man was a kidnapper, a rapist, a serial killer who eventually confessed to some 30 homicides in seven states, including five right here in Utah. Director Joe Berlinger is in the studio this morning to discuss this new fictionalized account of Bundy and his relationship with his longtime girlfriend in his new film, Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile. Welcome back to the Sundance Reel, Joe.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
So tell us what attracted you to this material and why now?
Yeah, well, it's actually the 30th anniversary of the execution of Bundy on January 24th, coincidentally the day that this festival started. Fortuitous, I suppose. Mm. But Bundy, I think, is an endless source of fascination, not just for me, but for many people. And I think the reason is he defies all of our expectations of what a serial killer we think should look like. I mean... You know, we all want to think that a serial killer is, you know, a creepy two-dimensional monster. And that implies that he's easily identifiable in society, and therefore you have some chance of avoiding becoming a victim. I think that's why people want to think that serial killers are that way. And some are. But Bundy was charming, charismatic, had lots of friends. He eluded capture. You know, friends thought there was no... Even when his legal woes started mounting, he had... supporters and fans. His Florida murder trial, when he was eventually caught, was a circus full of groupies of people who thought he was innocent and charming and sexy, and it's just bizarre.
And a judge who thought that too.
Yeah, and the judge allowed him to be, be his own legal counsel, which in and of itself made the trial quite a spectacle. But you know, Bundy taps into our worst, darkest fear. Not of being killed by a serial killer, that's a fear enough, but the deepest, darkest fear is you don't know the person next to you. And in my 25 years of doing crime, this is, you know, one of my first scripted movies, but as I think you know, I've done lots of crime, Brother's Keeper, Whitey, Paradise Lost, you know, lots of television. In my 25 years of covering real crime, you know, my observation and that of many others is the people who do evil in this world are usually those that you least expect. Whether it's a priest who commits pedophilia and then the next day he's holding, you know, mass, high school coach who, you know, is supposed to be a trusted person, or a football coach, you know, and does the wrong thing, or a guy like Ted Bundy who had a live-in girlfriend for 6 years, a woman he met in a bar named Elizabeth Cluffer in 1969, and they lived together until he got arrested in Utah in 1975 because of the Carol Duranche kidnapping. And even after that, she stuck with him. And he was, by all accounts, by her own memoir that the book was based on, he was a wonderful boyfriend and a wonderful surrogate father to her child from another relationship. And so for me, this film is not a, so much about a catalog of his killings. It's a very different kind of serial killer film. It's really about deception and betrayal.
So it could have easily been a documentary. Why the decision to make it narrative?
Well, interestingly, it is a documentary because I've had the bizarre experience this last 18 months that I also did a four-part series for Netflix called Conversations with a Killer, the Ted Bundy tapes, which premiered or was launched on Netflix on January 24th as well. Which sounds like some grand master plan on my part to own Bundy in 2019. And I'd like to take credit for, you know, how smart I am, that how everything lined up and it's all very coincidental. You know, the Netflix series is based on some audio tapes, the Bundy's final interview that had never been heard before. And when those tapes landed on my desk from the author of a book, Stephen Michaud was the author, and he wrote a book called Conversations with a Killer based on those audio tapes several decades ago. And he kind of pulled them out of his closet, was a fan of my work, and because of this, you know, insatiable appetite we have for true crime these days, he said, "Do you think there's a show here?" I said, "Let me listen to the tapes," and the tapes were chilling and haunting. And that four-part series is a deep dive into the mind of the killer. And a couple of months later, I was telling my agent at CAA, I'm interested in, you know, first of all, my agent is a huge true crime buff, so he was, you know, excited to hear all the details of my Bundy Unscripted show. But we also talked about how I'd like to take another run at doing a scripted movie. I haven't done one in 20 years. And he, because of my enthusiasm in quotation marks for what I was doing with Bundy, he said, you know, there's a script that's been kicking around Hollywood for 6 or 7 years. It's on what's called the Hollywood blacklist. The blacklist is scripts that, for one reason or other, people have tried to make, or they've won awards, screenwriting awards, and no one can figure out how to make them, but they're just kind of scripts that people want to keep an eye on, but nobody can figure out how to make them. And the script by Michael Wuerwe, called Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile, just kind of rolls off your tongue there, was on the Hollywood blacklist, and Michael Cooper, you know, blew the proverbial dust off the script and sent it to me and said, "What do you think?" And I loved it because I loved the POV, which was, you know, it's not really, you don't really know. I mean, you know, it's Bundy at the beginning of the film, but in the original conception of the script, you don't even know it's Bundy. It's just a story of Liz and Ted, and they're having a wonderful relationship, and then he falls into this Kafkaesque nightmare of wrongful accusation. And by the end of the film, the reveal is that it's Ted Bundy. Zac Efron signed on pretty quickly, and the fact that Zac was playing Ted Bundy became international news, and so the cat was out of the bag that it was Ted Bundy. So that conceit, that the reveal at the end that it's Ted Bundy, I had to modify, you know, do a little work on the script, which was great, just to, you know, deal with that issue that everyone knows going into the film, it's Ted Bundy. But the nuts and bolts of that script was about, you know, not talking about Bundy the killer, but Bundy the lover, until the right dramatic moment. You know, some people have feared when they read about the script that we're somehow glorifying Bundy. That's the last thing we're doing. We're portraying how one becomes a victim to that kind of psychotic behavior, and it requires the audience kind of investing a little emotion in the relationship between Ted and Liz. And so by the time Bundy finally admits to Liz at the end of the movie in this incredible scene that I think is, you know, just, I love the final scene, the final two scenes of the movie, you know, I want the audience to feel conflicted and feel betrayed themselves because they kind of invested a little energy, emotional energy, in the success of their relationship only to realize that this guy's a horrible person, even though intellectually, you know, it's Bundy. So if the film is working for you, that's the kind of feeling I hope you have at the end of the movie.
That's what I thought was interesting, as, you know, you're talking about glorifying Bundy, and having seen the film, you know, there are moments of levity It is entertaining. It is a window into a person. And then yet at the end, you bring it back around. So you do feel the weight of what has happened to, you know, to however many victims. And so I just felt like it was such a ride. And you brought it back to, yeah, to reality at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't interested in the, you know, like there are, excuse me for sniffling there. I've got the Sundance cough. You know, there are many great films. You know, we've seen the procedural, you know, escalating body count, who's doing the crime, you know, horrible, vicious acts. You know, Fincher obviously is the master, you know, tracking the killer down, and the end of the movie is the police, you know, arresting the bad guy. I wasn't interested in that. Film's been done 8,000 times. And I just wanted to, I was excited about the script because it gives me an opportunity to do what I think. And people may find this heretical, but, you know, as Bundy himself says, killers don't come out of the dark with long fangs and blood dripping off their chin. They're your brother, your father, you know, people you know, you love. And, you know, they could be the nicest people on the planet whom you admire, but the next day they could be capable of the most demonic evil. And that's a lesson we can't learn enough. And I think, you know, serial killers are three-dimensional human beings, and you have to see all sides of them to understand how this kind of sociopathic behavior happens so that you can avoid it. And, you know, as a father of daughters around the prototypical Bundy victim age, that's a lesson I want my daughters to know, which is you have to earn, you know, people have to earn your trust.
With all this Bundy, will you be able to take a Bundy vacation?
I got to take a Bundy vacation. too much murder on my brain. You know, okay.
So we have a couple more screenings?
A couple more screenings, but any distribution plans here?
Yeah, we're actually, luckily, we had a great screening and lots of people talking about buying the film, and we're sorting through the offers now.
Great. Awesome. Wednesday, January 30th at Sundance Mountain at 6 p.m. and then again Saturday here in town, 12:15 p.m. at the Eccles Theater. Thanks so much for
your
time.
Thanks for having me.
That's Director Joe Berlinger. You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
Cool.
Hi, Dan Dearden here, owner of Just Right Air, sponsor of KPCW programming. Just Right Air has been advising Park City area homeowners to repair, replace, and maintain their heating and air conditioning since 2004. Details at justrightair.com.
A big thank you to my co-host today, Katie Eldridge. Thanks, Katie. Our producer, Beth Fratkin. You can access the schedule by going online to kpcw.org. Additionally, we will be posting podcasts of each of the interviews by about 11 or 12.